All right, so as I said last week, we started a lesson called What Benevolence Means. We talked about the word benevolence. It has to do with basically giving goodwill to people in the form of different aspects here, as we'll talk about in just a second. Benevolence in the form of church work is any and all gifts given to one another, from a congregation to its own members, from a congregation to another congregation. These are works of service. These are works of fellowship. These are things that Christ expects us to do for one another. Not just says it would be nice if, but really does expect us to give benevolence in different forms. Personal benevolence, in other words, Christian to Christian benevolence, can include prayers and hospitality, demonstrations of godly love, demonstrations of mercy, acts of forgiveness, giving of food and clothing and essentials, as well as monetary gifts. That's just a recap of what we talked about last week. In fact, it comes right out of last week's lesson there as far as a recap. A church benevolence, in other words, what a congregation gives its own members in this case, is often in the form of money and food and provisions, and is often in response to a specific need. There's some kind of crisis going on that is outside of a person's control, and he calls upon the church to help him. And so the church responds to that need, in view of what is necessary there, and we'll talk about that in this lesson. So we can look at verses just to set things in motion as a general principle. Ephesians 4, 11 and 12. Paul says about Christ that he gave some as apostles, some as prophets, some as evangelists, some as pastors or elders and teachers for the equipping of the saints for the work of service to the building up of the body of Christ. That speaks in a big picture perspective. This is what Christ gives to all of his church, not to any one congregation. On the other hand, we can see that Christ does bless each congregation in different ways with different talents. Christ gives different gifts to different groups. He expects us to share those gifts and from our abundance. Some congregations, just like some Christians, have greater resources than others. We're well aware of the Matthew 25 parables, the man who received five talents and then two and then one. It's my belief, you don't have to agree to this, but my understanding is congregations kind of fall into that same category. Some congregations are five-talent congregations. Some are two, some are one. I'm not sure what we are, technically, but nonetheless, that's not my job to determine that. All I'm saying is that some congregations have far more to give than others do, and that's okay. They give according to what they have, not according to what someone else's congregation might have. Regardless of that, whether you buy into that or not, Christians ought to take care of one another. That's really the big message here, and especially when those other Christians in need have no other recourse. And, of course, that need is genuine. That does beg two big questions here that I hope to address in the short time that I have for this lesson. First of all, is benevolence only for fellow believers? Or can we give out of the funds collected to those who are not in Christ? There are different attitudes toward that. I think the scripture is clear, myself, but nonetheless, we are being influenced by social expectations and, sadly, denominational action. The other question is, what does need actually look like biblically? What does the need look like? Because if we're going to be giving according to a genuine need, we have to know what a need is. And so hopefully we'll address that as well. This lesson is not designed to examine every possible case that we could run across here, but it is really to establish some basic principles on this subject, and then how to apply those principles in those different scenarios that we will be faced with in due time. I do want to state up front, how a congregation uses its money is not the same as how an individual Christian uses his or her money. If there's one point that so many Christians do not understand, it is this right here. And that's why I'm stating it up front. You have your money, a congregation has its money, they are governed by different regulations, if you will. I don't like that word. It sounds official and technical, but that's truly true. They're regulated in different ways. And I'll talk about that here as much as I'm able to, and again, in the time allotted. Acts chapter 5, verse 4, we see Ananias and Sapphira, we know the story there, most of us. Here's a man who comes and lays some money at the apostles' feet, and Peter says, wait a minute, that's not the full amount that you are saying that it is. And so Ananias lied to Peter. And Peter makes a statement there in verse 4. He says, while that money remained in your control, it was used yours to use, basically, as you saw fit. No one was twisting your arm. But once you surrendered that money to the apostles, and really to the church, because the apostles are acting as representatives of the church here, it is no longer your money, but it is someone else's. Now, Peter didn't say all that, but that is the implication from what he did say, and you can read that on your own, and hopefully you'll see that same conclusion. All right, keep that point in mind as we look at 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7, where Paul says regarding our giving, our monetary offerings here, each one must do just as he purposed in his heart, or in his own heart is the implication there. In other words, again, no one is under compulsion to give. No one's being forced to give. Hopefully no one's being extorted to give, right, to the church. But once that money is released to the church as an offering to God, because that's how it should be viewed, not just I'm giving this money to this congregation, but I'm giving this money to God, and the congregation serves as an agent or a representative of God in taking care of that money. Once that is done, it is no longer in that person's control. Now it falls under a different realm, in a different area of control, and that would be the congregation itself, which is overseen by the leadership, the elders themselves. So we're seeing two very different contexts here. There's that personal money, and then there is that collected money. The personal money belongs to you. It's your money. The collected money belongs to the congregation. It's really God's money in a sense, but it is overseen by the congregation to whom it is given. And so that establishes a principle here, as I just said. What you do with your money is your business. Once you give that money in the form of an offering to God, it is no longer your money. And this is true if it is given to a congregation as well as it is given to a private party. For example, if David was in need of something and I gave personally out of my checking account to David to fulfill that need, whatever money I give to David is a gift. It is not a loan. It is a gift. And David can use that money however he sees fit. I intended it for a need, but David can use that in whatever way he chooses because it's no longer my money. Now it's his. And the same principle is being established here. So you can give your money to a good cause. You can give your money to a social charity. You can give your money to any charity of choice. You don't need the church's permission to do that. You don't even need God's permission to do that, with one caveat there, and that is that you can never support anything that contradicts the doctrine of God or violates your own conscience, because those are two ways to sin against God, and you should never do anything that would sin against God. God never gives you permission to sin against him. So understand the context here. All I'm trying to say up front here is, as you see on the screen, your money is your business. And once you release that control of that money, once you release interest of that money, the controlling interest, that is, now it belongs to someone else, and now we have different regulations or different oversight or different means of dealing with that money. So once that money is given to the church in the form of either a special offering or even our regular collection like we take up every Sunday, that belongs to the congregation itself. And the New Testament is very clear that no one is to be a recipient of this money except for Christians. We have no other example. So what we're really seeing then is that God's money that is collected in God's name is given to God's people. That is the same formula, the same precedent, the same example, the same method that we see time and time again in the book of Acts, in the book of Romans, in the book of 1 Corinthians, in the book of 2 Corinthians. I think I put all the biblical references in your notes, even though I'm not citing them here, because we did actually cover them last week. So that means then that we don't solicit money from unbelievers, nor does the church give money to unbelievers. And what that means then is that this idea of fundraisers for an allegedly sacred work, which is hopefully what we're engaged in as a church, really in the form of selling merchandise and services to unbelievers, is unbiblical. That is purely a commercial enterprise. And likewise, the idea of collecting money in God's name to give to people who don't belong to God. And I'm talking about that spiritual relationship. They have no spiritual relationship with God, also is unbiblical. In every direct case of church benevolence, which again we covered last week, we see again the same process. Christians with abundance giving benevolence in the form of money to Christians who are in need. We never see the church giving to social welfare programs. We never see the church just giving to generally the poor or you know those who are in needs, have needs of a secular nature. We don't see that. So the New Testament pattern is really important to cite here because we don't have any other authority to go by. And if we just move that New Testament pattern aside and say, well, you know, I know it says that, but this is what we feel like we should do. Well, if we can do that with benevolence, then we can do that with anything. Once we remove the pattern for one subject, why not remove it for the next one too? And then the next one and the next one, so on. Pretty soon we just don't need a New Testament pattern anymore. Let's just do the church thing however we want to. But if we're going to be a church that is truly of Christ, I don't mean just in our name, but more importantly in our character and in our function. If we're going to be a church that is of Christ, we need to do it the way that Christ has laid out. So we never see any form of physical benevolence, material or financial help, that is, given from Christ's churches to those who aren't Christians, even in times of crisis. The Acts 11, verse 28 through 30 example that we looked at last week there. We have Christians who are in need in Judea, and Paul goes and collects from Christians throughout the predominantly Gentile regions of the Roman Empire, and he brings all that money and he gives it to all of Jerusalem, right? No, he gives it to the church that is in Judea because that's where the need was and that's all that received it. And I know someone's going to come back and say, well, that just sounds heartless, as you see there. And that's an emotional response there. And the reason for that, the reason why we think that sometimes, and I'm not saying that it's just people out there that think that. I understand that sometimes we even think that in the sense of, you know, we're not clear on this. It's because denominational churches have so abused the mission of the church and the purpose for giving in the first place, and many have been misled by that. I'm telling you straight up, as clear as I can, that this whole business of benevolence and how we are to give and to whom we are to give and so on is dictated by the New Testament pattern, and we have no right to abandon that. In fact, it obscures our true work. As you see on the screen there, the mission of the church is not to help people pay their bills, unbelievers that is, and to feed all the hungry and to support all the homeless and to support all the women's shelters and the widows and the orphans. You can do this as a Christian because remember, it's your money. Your money is in your control. You do what you want with your money. But once you give that money to God, now it's under a different control. And that control says that that money that's collected is only to be used for certain things. And is to be used ultimately for the betterment and the promotion of God's people and the gospel of Christ there. So that's what God is saying, but we don't always look at that. And sometimes we get confused because our emotions kick in, right? We're human. I get that. But we want to think with our head here and not just with our heart. So once we give our money to God, that means that it needs to be used in a manner that he prescribes, not as the world expects us to use it, or as a denomination chooses to use that. Let the other churches do whatever they want. We can't stop that. We have no control over that. And let the world expect us to go and feed all the hungry, you know, and have soup kitchens and everything else. That it can think whatever it wants about us. Frankly, I don't care. I hope you don't either. But the fact is, we have a mission, and that mission is very clear. Granted, and it is a granting here, there is a measure of human judgment involved in how we use our money. And the reason I say that is because Paul didn't say in every case how that money, once it's given to the need, is actually used. And so you think about that we use collected money in this congregation for building maintenance and utilities. Obviously, we have lights and plumbing. Those things cost money. Extra biblical literature in the form of handouts or worksheets or, you know, whatever kind of stuff that is used for that. Computers, projectors, the PowerPoint you're looking at right now, this congregation bought that. We bought the projector, we bought the computer, we bought the program, we bought all that. Your money that you gave to this group bought that. You might look at that directly and say, well, how does that exactly help the Christians and so on? Well, it does, because we're using that as a tool to teach. And we're using that to make the teaching more effective and more efficient. And there is a measure of judgment in there, because we can use other tools that may not be as effective or efficient. And if they are less so, then we need to question that, possibly even get rid of them. We don't have any sacred cows in the church, where we need to protect that and hold on to that no matter what. So ideally, all these things that we're talking about are intended to help or to benefit or to edify fellow Christians. And I want to reiterate, if they're not doing that, then we have no business spending God's money on them. But if they are doing that, then it falls under that umbrella principle, if you will, that that says that we're having to make some human judgments in the midst of non-specific instruction. God says, take this money and use it toward this need, and the need is diverse, and the need is not always spelled out biblically. We have to use our discretion as to how to use that money. I will say this, though, that 1 Timothy chapter 5, 21, Paul says, I solemnly charge you, Timothy, in the presence of God and of Christ Jesus, to maintain these principles without bias, doing nothing in a spirit of partiality. Now, he's not talking about money, really. He's talking about elders, and he's talking about the appointment of them and then the discipline of them and the exoneration of them in the cases of accusations and so on. Basically, what he's saying is, it doesn't matter how good of a friend you are to these elders or how good of a friend they are to you, you do what's right no matter what. And don't let friendship color how you act toward them in regard to what is right. That serves as a good guiding principle for us with regard to money. Let's not let our friendships, our familyships, our relationships and our emotions dictate how we do God's business. We need to address what is right, not simply what makes us feel good or makes you feel good or makes me feel good. I hope we're clear on that. So no conflict of interest, no partiality. We keep talking in this whole couple lessons here about those who are in need, and so far we've identified the who, but we haven't identified the what. The who are in need are Christians. They are believers. But the what is the need itself. And I'm going to go a roundabout way of talking about that because, well, I'll just admit up front that the New Testament just doesn't say specifically. It doesn't have a verse that says, here is the need, and then lays it all out. But it does lay it out. You just have to kind of look for it. You have to do some investigation here. So let me start out in 1 Timothy chapter 5, verse 3 through 16, where Paul gives some pretty elaborate instructions on what's called widows indeed. In fact, he says more verse by verse here, than he does on the subject of elders. He gives more verse attention, if you will, to this subject than he does even on elders, which I find pretty remarkable, but obviously it's a point that needs clarifying. He's not just talking about all widows, but those who are dedicated to the church work and therefore are eligible for ongoing financial support from the congregation. In my opinion, you don't have to agree with this, my opinion is the reason why Paul spent so much time on that is why we're still spending much time on this discussion right now, is because when you start talking about money and then start talking about emotions and start talking about people in need, then all this gets fuzzy. And we start using fuzzy logic rather than, rational thinking. So Paul has a specific criteria for these women who are widows indeed. In the process, he also identifies those who are not qualified. By the way, all of that information, those who are in need truly, and then those who are not qualified, that's all part of the New Testament pattern. So don't think that this is something, extracurricular or, outside the pattern. It's actually part of the pattern. And it teaches us something. It teaches us some principles here. Chapter 5, verse 4, 1 Timothy 5, verse 4, Paul lays the initial burden of these widows, whoever they are, on the widow's family. And he gives two reasons for this, verse 4 and verse 16. First of all, he says, this is acceptable to God. So the family is supposed to step in and take care of that. And the reason for that is in verse 16, so that the church would not be burdened. Because the church is not meant to be a, helping out widows institution. That's not its main function. That's something that we can do if necessary, but that's not our primary action there. Our primary action is to, as we said earlier, you know, preach the gospel and share that message there. So there's two things there. First of all, it's acceptable to God for family to be the first responder, and secondly, not to put a burden on the congregation. If you were looking at verse 8 there, it says if one does not provide for his own, in other words, if a family doesn't take care of the widow in their own midst, and especially for those of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. That's pretty strong language in the midst of all this. So what Paul is saying there is if the family refuses to take care of the widow that it's responsible for, then that's worse action than if they were unbelievers. He's talking about Christians here. So that begs the question, well, how serious is Paul about this? Is he just offering some suggestions? No, it's very clear that he's being very blunt, very pointed in his comments here about this. So, widows who are widows indeed are obviously women who are in desperate need of help. They have no other recourse but the church. And it says not only can they turn to the brethren for help, but God expects them to do so, and he expects us to rise to that occasion and do what we can. Now, what we can may be less than what another congregation can, but that's not the point. We are to help, but only if she meets those qualifications or conditions there. That scenario that I just described is very different from the two others that I'm going to describe. The first one here is in Acts chapter 6, verse 1 through 6, where we have some of the Hellenistic or simply Greek-born Jewish widows who are being fed by the church in Jerusalem. These aren't just any widows. The context really doesn't allow for any other conclusion than that these are Christians. They are newly baptized Christians that the church is taking care of. Deacons in the church are appointed to oversee the daily serving of this food. The church provided the food, or at least provided the money for it, and the church distributed the food as it was needed to those who belonged to the church. Once again, we see a limited group of people. We see also a limited situation here. There's nothing that suggests that this was a permanent situation, but rather a temporary one. And it falls on the heels of what we looked at last week in Acts chapter 2 and Acts chapter 4, where there was a great need. We have all these new Christians, okay, newly baptized Christians who are in Jerusalem and are feeding on the teaching of the apostles and the breaking of bread, in other words, sharing of meals together as well as the Lord's Supper. And we see all that going on. And in order to take care of all those people while they're there in getting all that very necessary information, the church is feeding them as well. So that's when you see people selling their property and laying the proceeds at the feet of the apostles, or really just giving it to the church there. If you look ahead to Acts chapter 8, verse 4, you find out that the persecution, ironically started by later the apostle Paul himself, who's now called Saul, you find him causing a huge persecution within Jerusalem, and it says that the church was dispersed. And it seems to me, it's just my opinion, but it seems to make sense that at that point, those kinds of needs that the church was taking care of are ended because now people are leaving Jerusalem rather than staying, and they're taking that gospel message with them, and they're carrying it back to their homelands. All right, so there's one scenario, which is very different than the 1 Timothy 5 scenario, which is ongoing support for widows indeed. Here's another scenario that's provided in James 1:27. He says, pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is this, to visit orphans and widows in their distress. And I've been told by different people, not a lot in the church, but certainly a lot without the church, in other words, outside of the church, many in the denominational world assume that this is a work of the church. Not sure how they get that out of that verse, except that they're saying that, see, this is what the church needs to do. But it doesn't say that. It's really talking about individual Christians. In fact, if you look at the audience that James writes to, it's not to any particular church. It's specifically to Christians. And so he gives this information to the to individual Christians, and he says it's your job, individual Christians, to, you know, visit the orphans and widows in their distress. This falls under the same category as Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 3, where it says, you know, remember the prisoners. And a lot of people, especially denominations, have taken that to mean that we're supposed to start prison ministries and that we're supposed to bring preachers into the jailhouses and start converting the felons and the convicts that are there. And while that may work and while that may be done, there's nothing prohibiting them, but that's not what that verse teaches. That verse talks about the prisoners as being those who are in prison for their faith. And he's talking to Christians to remember those people who are in prison for their faith. He's not talking about those who have been caught, you know, in crimes and out there, you know, in murder or theft or anything else. He's talking about Christians. Christians helping other Christians. And so we're to remember those people. But again, denominations and sometimes even churches that call themselves churches of Christ take it upon themselves and say, we need a prison ministry. And in like manner, James 1:27, they look at that and they say, well, we need an orphanage. Or we need to, you know, set up some kind of ongoing support for all widows or all women or even a women's shelter. Why stop there, right? I mean, why not just keep going with that? So once you do open that door, I'm not about all the fear and safety thing here, but this is a road that you go down that once you go through that door, there really is no stopping that, and that because you've left behind the New Testament pattern. Remember, it's the pattern that keeps us intact as to what we believe and what we do and how we carry out our business as a church. It's a New Testament pattern that has to be dealt with. So James is not talking here about the collective work of the church. He's talking to individuals. We could say the same thing about helping the poor and the hungry and the homeless. There's not a scripture in the New Testament that prohibits you from helping those people by yourself with your money, because remember, your money is your business. And if you want to donate your money to those causes, well, then that's your deal. You can do that. You don't need my permission. You don't need the church's permission. As long as it's not sinful what you're doing, then it's allowable. Then God says you can do what you want with your own. But once you give your money to the church, that's God's business. Now you're in a different realm altogether. And you can't mix these things up here and say that one is like the other. And that what you give it to God, now we can use it as if it were our own. No, that's just not true. And that's just poor Bible study. Widows and orphans is a phrase that actually comes out of the Old Testament depicting a helpless group of people, often with no other recourse except charitable donations. Christians, not congregations, can help those people. The mission of the church is not to take care of all widows, unless they're widows indeed, as Paul said, nor to support orphans or orphanages. We are to do the one thing that no one else in the world is allowed to do. Think about that. The one thing in the world that no one else in the world is allowed to do, and that is to preach the gospel in its accuracy and its entirety. No one else has the right to do that but the church of those who are saved through that gospel. So in order for a congregation to give to help its to give help to its own members in the congregational benevolence context here, there has to be a need. And as I said, the New Testament doesn't come out and say, here's what need looks like, but it does provide basic understanding and also what needs are not. I can say up front that any need is a genuine need if we've already committed to it. For example, if we have bills to pay in this congregation, like a light bill, or you know, if we had a property tax, I don't think we do because, well, we're exempt from that. But if we had those kinds of things and if we had other kinds of obligatory things, well, those are needs that have to be met because we've committed to them. Paying your preacher, by the way, if you've committed to that, well, then that's a need. And it's not a need because you have to pay preachers. It's a need because you promise to. And it's the promise or the commitment that makes that need in force. Just like individuals are supposed to keep their promises, so are our congregations. So if we've promised something, again, as long as it's not sinful, then we need to carry that promise out. We need to fulfill that. Otherwise, a need presents itself in the form of necessities for survival for one's family and one's self. This is not, and I have to stress this is not talking about maintaining one's lifestyle as they have come to know it, okay? So say, I'll just put a silly example. Say you're used to spending, I don't know, $100 a week at Starbucks, and then suddenly you come into desperate times and you have a financial crunch, and now you can't do that anymore, and you come to the church and you say, I have a need because I'm not getting my Starbucks quota met for the week. Well, that's just your lifestyle as you've come to know it. And we have no obligation to fulfill that because that's not a genuine need. You don't need that for survival. Coffee you need for survival, but not necessarily Starbucks, okay? I just want to say. All right, so James chapter 2, verse 15 and 16. Let's look at that here. Let's see what James says there. James chapter 2, verse 15 and 16. It says, if a brother or sister is without clothing and in need of daily food, and one of you says to them, go in peace, be warmed and be filled, and you do not give them what is necessary for their body, what use is that? James gives you something really insightful here. He's telling you what a need looks like. And the need is in the form of food, it's in the form of clothing, it's in the form of basically essential needs, needs for survival, everyday needs that people, humans need. And it goes right along with what Jesus talked about in Matthew 25 that I cited last week, when Jesus says, when you saw me hungry or naked or, you know, without clothing or something like this, and you fulfilled that need that I had, it goes hand in hand with that. So James is saying the same thing that Jesus is saying there. There are necessary provisions. In the New Testament examples, need involves critical needs, not personal expectations. So someone can't say, well, I need the church to help me out with my cable TV bill or my Visa bill or reloading my Starbucks card or my lawn care service or my pet care service or something like that. Those are not genuine needs because you don't need those to critically survive. But if you're out without food or without clothing or if your house just burned down or something like that, well, that's a whole different story. One's refusal to be productive and gainfully employed does not create a need that we have to respond to. I wish I could spend more time on this, but 2 Thessalonians chapter 3, verse 6 through 10, in the reading that we had there, Paul sets an example of not becoming a burden to the church by what? By being gainfully employed on his own. He says, we work night and day so as not to be a burden to you. Now, Paul had a right as a preacher to be compensated by the church, but he forewent that, and he says, I'm trying to set a pattern of how I want to be treated so that you don't accuse me of just preaching for money is basically the implication there. Paul does say, though, if a man will not work, then let him go hungry. Think about that. One who doesn't work, let him go hungry. And you're thinking, well, that sounds cold and heartless, but that's an apostle inspired by the Holy Spirit saying this, because God does not want us to be enabling Christians to be irresponsible. In fact, we could say that it is irresponsible for us if we use God's money to enable irresponsibility. Now we become aiding and abetting those kinds of behaviors. We have no right to do that. In fact, it is unwise and even unloving to do that. Which is the irony here, because a lot of people say, we need to act out of love for that person, and God in his love says, let him go hungry. So we need to define love by how God measures it, not by how we feel about it. So it's not the church's responsibility to bail members out of their own poor money management, or their poor spending habits, or their failure to set aside for their own expenses, especially when they know those expenses are coming. So we cannot allow feelings of pity to override a sense of duty and stewardship entrusted to us by God. That's a big, strong point there. And it's a point that often gets set aside because, again, people let their emotions dictate the scenario rather than their head or even the scriptures. One final point to make in the time I have, that is that if a member is in need and the need is genuine, then they need to ask for help. The reason for that is that shepherds cannot read people's minds. We tell everyone, Jim and I have been telling that to everyone that we go to in your homes when we're going with that shepherd and member expectation sheet. We cannot read your minds. So if you have something that is a need, we may not know about it. We don't know everything that's going on. We may overlook legitimate crises of our members. And we don't have to go around asking every member after services, hey, do you need any money? Do you need anything? How are you doing on food? You know, how are you doing with necessities? You know, that's just not our job to do that. And that's ridiculous to think about it that way. So members' responsibility is to make the request to the shepherds and offer whatever information is necessary to establish whether this is a genuine need or not. I want to say here, positively, that if here in this congregation we have members who are in need of essentials and that need is proven legitimate, we're happy to help. We're happy to address that need. But it's not the shepherd's responsibility to initiate that process, and don't think that we're judging anyone by asking questions or making investigation. That's just being good stewards. That is being responsible on our part there. I want to say that the design of these lessons is not to provide numerous examples of everyone who can receive benevolence all under every condition, every situation possible. Rather, it's to lay out some biblical principles and apply them as needed. Individual benevolence, Christian to Christian, is far less regulated than church benevolence simply because really only one person is involved, and that is you. The money that is involved belongs to you. It's in your power to use as you see fit. Church benevolence is a different matter. It demands greater regulation because many people are involved, and that invites opportunity for abuse, misuse, and conflicts of interest. You know this in the secular world. The same thing can happen in the religious world. So let me just end it with this, that benevolence is really not about money as much as it is two things. First of all, there is the disposition of your heart and your care for God's people. And then secondly, there is the stewardship factor there. And that is acting responsible toward what God has entrusted you, personally or as a congregation. And we're going to answer for all that. We're going to give an account for ourselves and this group. If the need is present, believe that God will provide for that need. Not always directly, but often indirectly, through other people, other sources. But remember, too, that we're not in the business of supporting irresponsible members, financially or otherwise, who refuse to listen to the word and follow the same apostolic instruction that the rest of us are supposed to follow. No one is exempt there. Just as God is not partial, neither should we be partial. We want to help genuine needs. Let's do that. At the same time, we don't want to help someone who to be irresponsible and to enable that through our own misuse of our time and our responsibilities here. I hope that these couple lessons have provided some material to think about here, and hopefully you will ponder these things and think about that. This hasn't been a lesson evangelical in nature, in the sense of, trying to win souls and so on, but at the same time, the offer is there. If there's anyone that is ready to become a Christian, or if you are a Christian and you have some spiritual needs we can help you with, let us do so. As we stand and sing the song, Bob has selected for us here.